Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to IDVAC Blog Talk Radio, brought to you by the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community, in collaboration with the Women of Color Network and the African American Domestic Peace Project. IDVAC Blog Talk Radio is made possible by a grant from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Administration for Children and Families, Family and Youth Services Bureau, and Family Violence Prevention and Services Program. Now, points of view expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the official positions or policies of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. IDVAC Blog Talk Radio brings you rich conversations and education on issues surrounding domestic violence in African American and African communities.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to the Women of Color Network, Inc. Radio Show Hour, where we will discuss specific topics related to domestic violence and its impacts on the African American community. The Women of Color Network, Inc. works to end violence against all women by centralizing the voices and leadership of women of color and their communities. If you are in immediate danger or feel unsafe in your homes or relationships, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233. That's 1-800-799-SAFE. And now on to tonight's show.
Hello, and welcome to the Women of Color Network, Inc. Monthly Radio Hour blog, where we bring you a range of topics addressing domestic violence in the African American community. As a national network of women of color, we use our collective voices to advocate for and educate communities about women who experience violence and also hold violent abusers accountable. We use our radio blog show as a means to engage our guests and community on important issues that all of us should be talking about and taking action on wherever we are and wherever we can. My name is Sister Samaya Fire. I am one of your hosts for this evening for the IDVAC and WOCN Blog Talk Radio Show. I am the Leadership Program Director at the WOCN. In addition to other roles, I work as a national trainer on a variety of topics, as well as a longtime advocate for women, children, and families who experience domestic and sexual violence, and I work as an independent consultant and organizer on social justice and human rights issues. My co-host tonight, as always, is my community sidekick, the fabulous Miss Alice, who joins me here on the Radio Blog Show. Hello, Miss Alice. Are you there tonight?
Good evening, dear heart. I am so pleased to be able to spend this hour with you and our guests tonight. Good evening, listening audience. I am Alice Lynch, and I am the chairperson for the Women of Color Network Board of Directors, and I, too, am an independent consultant that works with restorative justice, restorative practice, domestic violence, and other areas that interest me and that I take to heart, which is one of the good things about being independent. You do what you want to do. We're delighted to have our guests with us tonight, and we're going to go ahead and get started because there's a lot to talk about. So, Sister Samaya, go ahead and introduce our first guest.
Okay, I will do that. Our first guest tonight is Alisa Zaria. She is the Associate Director of the Center for Race and Gender at UC Berkeley. She's also a member of the Survived and Punished and the Free Marissa Now Mobilization Campaign. She's co-editor of Community Accountability, Emerging Movements to Transform Violence as a Special Issue of Social Justice, a Journal of Crime, Conflict, and World Order. Ms. Alice, you can introduce our next guest.
Well, great. And I'd like to welcome our next guest, Marissa Alexander. Was arrested and charged with aggravated assault in August of 2010 for firing a single warning shot after being attacked by her then-estranged husband. In August of 2012, Marissa was sentenced to 20 years in prison under Florida's harsh minimum mandatory sentencing policies, which was definitely not okay. Excuse me a minute, I just dropped my phone.
Mm-hmm.
I am so sorry.
No problem.
I think I might have cut. Did I cut myself off or am I still here?
Oh, still here. You're fine.
Okay. Maya, will you go ahead and finish introducing Marissa?
Absolutely. No problem. So in 2013, an appellate court overturned her case as a result of faulty jury instruction. And after a long journey fighting for freedom, Marissa accepted her original plea agreement, and that will come to a close on January 27th, which is like next week. And Marissa Alexander has also founded in 2016 the Marissa Alexander Justice Project, which seeks to provide services that promote unity through the collaboration of anti-domestic violence movements, social justice, and criminal reform. So we'd like to welcome both guests tonight, and we thank you very much for being a part of this show tonight. Are you both there?
Yes. I'm sorry. I pulled the plug from the phone.
Okay.
Marissa, we're going to start with you. So my first question for you, and I think this is appropriate place to start, and I'm sure people are just wondering about this, and you've probably been asked this plenty of times, but do you think the fact that you were a woman of color contributed to the sentence that you received and how you were treated by the Florida courts?
I believe that the sentence was, I mean, the sentence is basically, it's a state legislator. I think what impacted me was the fact that I was African American and they chose to enhance it because they had the discretion to do so. I was able to see while I was incarcerated different cases that were like mine for women that, you know, that were not women of color, and they did not have the enhancement placed on them, and they didn't even, so they got away with stuff like they were able to have probation and things like that for gun charges, aggravated assault. So it was to me was interesting.
Okay, but had you, before your case, I'm just curious, were you aware of other cases of similar issues that were occurring with white women and they may not have received the same harsh treatment?
See, before my case, I wasn't even involved. I wouldn't have a need to look into it. Once I got, you know, in the situation and I was incarcerated, is then when I further looked into it. So before my case, no, I wouldn't have looked into that.
Okay, good. All right. Samaya?
Okay, so, Elisa, I'm going to ask you a similar question because of the work that you were involved in with the Free Marissa Now Mobilization Campaign and also with currently now with Survived and Punished, which comes out of that mobilization campaign. In your opinion and your perspective, based on what we've learned and the things that we experienced during that campaign, do you think that black women who go through the criminal justice system are treated in a different way, or that there are some discriminatory practices within the criminal justice system?
I do. Thank you so much for inviting me and for asking such a great question. I think that the prisons and policing and prosecution, basically the whole entire criminal punishment system, is premised on racism and particularly anti-black racism. And I think that survivors of domestic violence who are targeted for criminalization, like Marissa was, are more likely to receive high sentences if they are black or if they are immigrant or marginalized in some other way. Just like Marissa said, that's exactly what happened to her. we know that racism played a part in her prosecution, because Angela Corey was very intentional about painting Marissa as angry instead of afraid, right? That was sort of the argument for why she wasn't a genuine domestic violence victim. And we all know that there is a longstanding racist and sexist trope of the angry black woman that Ms. Corey was clearly pulling on, and the judge agreed with. That was the judge who made the decision to deny Marissa the chance to get stand your ground immunity. So, yes, I think that racism is systematic. I think that it weaves itself in the ways that domestic violence works, the ways that prosecution works and imprisonment works. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And so I want to continue in that vein of the conversation with what we have also learned with cases that are on the SurviveAndPunish.org website. There are several other survivors, victims of domestic violence, that have had similar experiences in terms of how they have been treated by law enforcement, by the criminal justice system. So if we take Marissa's case off the table and just talk about this in a more broad way about how women of color, in particular, how African American victims are depicted, punished for surviving. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, yeah, if folks want to go to the website, it's Survived and Punished. Those are past tense, survivedandpunished.org. And you'll see a number of survivors of domestic and sexual violence who have been criminalized, imprisoned, or deported. According to the ACLU, nearly 60% of people in women's prison nationwide, and as many as 94% of some women's prison populations have a history of physical or sexual abuse before being incarcerated. Professor Beth Ritchie from University of Illinois Chicago, who's an expert on the intersections of domestic violence in prisons, wrote a really fascinating book years ago called Compelled to Crime, when she interviewed sisters inside, survivors inside, and talked to them about the road between the practice of trying to survive domestic violence and ultimately being targeted for prosecution. There's clearly some pipeline. There's a pipeline between the experience of domestic violence, the choices that survivors feel like they have to make in order to defend their lives, and the state ultimately prosecuting them for it. It can be self-defense, as in Marissa's case, and also as in the case of Breisha Meadows, the 15-year-old black girl in Ohio who protected herself by allegedly shooting her father, who was extremely abusive to her and her family. Breisha tried to contact the police to get help, and the police turned her away. So she was left with nothing, and in order to rescue her life, she ended up allegedly shooting her father. And so instead of giving that young girl support, that young black girl support, they put her in juvenile detention and are considering prosecuting her for murder. So self-defense is definitely one action, survival action, that survivors get criminalized for. Migration, moving across borders in order to stay safe, removing children from abusive people, being coerced into acting as an accomplice in some criminalized activity, securing resources needed to live. I mean, all these kinds of actions are things that people do in order to stay alive. And instead of our systems supporting, having the backs of those survivors, we end up punishing them. So it's a systematic, it's a structural problem.
Thank you, Alisa. I appreciate that. So, Ms. Alice?
Okay. Marissa, you, on behalf of other women, you started your foundation. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your foundation and how it got started?
Well, thank you. My foundation got started based on, you know, my passion and the situation that I went through and encountered. And I had an opportunity where most people don't to have, experience at the ground level in terms of, I think a lot of the time you have a bird's eye view, so you see it from six or you hear about it, but to actually live in the environment for 3 years and see the things that I got to see. And then once I came home, got to see it from a bird's eye view, it just became a real strong passion for me to continue to move forward. Not only that, I figured the best thing to do to me is joy and giving. So this is the best way I can give back to, you know, all that, you know, rallied to help me, the Free Marissa Now and everybody, people that wrote me all over the world. So this is my, you know, my service back because, I mean, I'm, you know, really a servant at heart. So what it is it's basically, the nonprofit is to against domestic violence and as well as criminalization of victims. And there's other things that I also encountered through the system, which I believe a part of the 1020 life sentence is a part of your, you know, mass incarceration. You give long sentences for long times. That's part of the mass incarceration, as well as, you know, policy reform. We will also target policy reform, sentencing disparities, because that was just something that I experienced. There was no way for a first-time offender or anything that I should have ever been given the enhancement, especially when that enhancement of the 1020 life was for habitual violent offenders and different things like that. So that's a focus of my organization, and to be a part of having those conversations, really difficult conversations, very honest conversations, because I could speak from actually living and being in this system for 3 years, what I encountered after, and then what I endured and encountered as a survivor of that particular relationship, which was very short but very intense, and some women don't make it out of it. So those are the things, and I have a passion for the young people too, because I see so many of the young women and young girls that experience it and have experienced it for a long time, or you know, at a young age, and just what to look for as far as awareness. So my nonprofit encompasses all of the things that I feel like I experienced and a few additional things that I think will overall help our community, such as restoration of parole and first-time offender and court intervention as well, because those are things I think that we don't get to take apart, get to benefit from. Parole, like Florida is a life-is-life state. There is no parole. And I've seen cases where people are in there for robbery and nobody was murdered. And they've been there for 25 years, and different things like that. So it's all encompassing for me to just be a part of something that will impact, you know, my community, the Black community.
Well, we're going to give you a minute to do a commercial for your nonprofit. How do people find out more information or get in touch with you or even make a donation?
Okay, right now my website is in process of coming up, but if you went to www.marissaalexander.org, you will be able to see my coming soon splash page, and on there is a link where you can type in contact us, and what will happen is it will forward me an email. The idea is that it will go live with next week because that's the week that I'll be done with all this probation and house arrest. So if you would like to get in touch with me, you can go through that link, www.marissaalexander.org, and that's where you go. When you go right now, it's a splash page, but moving forward, after next week will be my full launch webpage, and you'll be able to donate, and all the things I'm into, pictures and different things, will be there as well.
Okay, thank you. Sister
Samaya? Yeah, so Marissa, I think what I want to say before I go to Alisa to ask her an additional question. First, I want to say I am so proud of you and so excited for you as you are coming off of the what you refer to as the ankle monitor, and that you will have completed your probationary period and that you will be able to begin your life anew, and that you will also be doing your work in your community and across the country and internationally,
right,
and wherever, you know, your journey,
right,
takes you. I am so super excited for you and just really glad that we're able to have you on this radio blog show as you are beginning that part of your life. And so
Thank you.
We really wish you the best. We love you dearly. We support you 100%. And in any way that I think that we can continue to support you, you know, you let us know, and we're there for you.
Thank you. I'm extremely happy. It was never punishment, always preparation for this. So they did me a favor, actually.
It's God's favor, straight to your address.
Thank you.
So the thing is, I wanted to ask you, Alisa, as we are celebrating Marissa's release, are there other defense campaigns that we should be lifting up at this time as well?
Yes, thank you so much. So today, it's wonderful that this interview was scheduled for today, because today is also the Free Brescia Day of Action. So earlier this morning, there was a Twitter Power Hour when folks who are supporting Brescia Meadows' freedom got together and on Twitter and talked about some of the conditions in which survivors are being criminalized and the details about her case, and just expressing our support and solidarity with her. There's just a ton of information on that defense campaign website, which is Free Brescia, freebrescia.com. So I urge folks to go check it out. And because we've got January 19th was the Brescia Day of Action, and then January 27th, as Marissa just discussed, is her last day, where we're going to be celebrating her freedom, we wanted to take that opportunity, given those two bookends, to spend the week highlighting different campaigns that are at pivotal moments that are doing everything they can to free survivors of violence who've been criminalized. And so some of those survivors include Tundalo Hall from Oklahoma, Kai Peterson from Georgia, Kelly Ann Savage here in California, Rasmia Ode in Chicago, Illinois, Alicia Walker, and also in Illinois, Nee Norn here in California. And so all of these folks have experienced sexual violence and or domestic violence, and also have been criminalized as a result of the actions that they took in order to survive that violence. It's different kinds of contexts, different kinds of locations, you know, really diverse kinds of experiences in many ways. But also this is the thread that they have in common. So on the survivedandpunished.org page, on the very homepage, there's a link that brings you to the page with all these cases, and it gives you concrete ways to take action to support the campaigns to help free these survivors.
And Alisa, thank you for remembering all of those other person's names. It's important for us to lift those people up and to garner support for them. I want you to talk a little bit about, to break it down just a little bit more. When you're talking about criminalizing victims, you know, can you say a little bit more about what that means?
Sure. Criminalizing, do you mean what that means institutionally?
Institutionally, yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that there's a couple ways to think about it. One is basically the ways in which survival actions are read by the criminal justice system, right? And so self-defense, which, you know, we all think should be everyone's right, when a survivor of domestic violence defends herself, I think she is more likely to be criminalized, right? So that right to self-defense is more likely to be negated if she's a survivor of domestic violence because of the sexism that exists in our culture. So So that's what I mean by criminalized, and the kinds of experiences or the ways in which criminalization happens is a number of ways that people get targeted by police if police are called. People get targeted by prosecutors. Prosecutors try to go for the highest amount of years that they can. Judges don't believe survivors often, question their experiences, question their credibility. Survivors who are immigrants, they get targeted by both prisons and immigration punishment systems, right? So some survivors we've seen actually successfully getting released from prison, but then they get picked up by ICE directly after. So there's this whole other kind of criminalization that happens for immigrant survivors. So those are those are some of the institutional ways in which that happens. But then there's this other way in which survivors get punished in a more general kind of way. So even if they're not getting criminalized by the state, there is this this way in which survivors are getting punished in our communities. They're not being supported. They're being blamed. There are many people in our communities that are, beautifully support survivors, but I do want to bring attention to the ways in which survivors aren't supported by our families and our neighbors and so on and so forth, because that lack of support is connected to the ways in which survivors are getting criminalized by these institutions. So what we need to do is to strengthen a culture of love and support for survivors of domestic violence, a clear sort of rejection of domestic violence, continuing to support survivors' rights to live, to defend themselves, to parent their children, and so on and so forth. I think that those principles need to be threaded through every single facet of our communities. So, yeah.
Yes, it's threaded through our communities as well as through the services that we provide to our communities, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because it's important for services, in my perspective, it's important for services to send a clear message that self-defense is a right. So. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With that, we're going to just take a break for a moment. But before we do that, I want to remind our callers that, if you know someone who is a victim of domestic violence or if you who are listening is a victim of domestic violence and you're looking for options to safety, the phone number for you to call is the National Domestic Violence Hotline. And that number is 800-799-7233, or you can call 1-800-799-SAFE, S-A-F-E. So we're going to take a break for just a moment, then we're going to come back and continue our conversation with Marissa Alexander and Alisa Bayaria. Thank you very much.
To Sister Tanya Lovelace and the staff and advisors of the Women of Color Network, on behalf of Tony Porter, Bishop Freeze, and a call to men, all the men here want to say thank you. We want to recognize and thank you for the hard work and efforts to address and challenge the rights of women of color in the movement today. We just want to let y'all know we ain't got nothing but love for you. Nothing but love. Out to all the women of color, from a call to being dead, well-meaning brothers, cause We appreciate the hard work that you do. With all due respect, we just want to say thank you for challenging us all to be better people. Like Dr. King said, we all created equal. Staying on the front lines of the struggle. Always do the rescue for women in trouble. For crimes like sexual assault and DVs. Eliminating violence on women and family. Addressing human trafficking and police brutality. Right here in the United States. And that's reality. Well done, sister's job well done. For the call to action for each one. Teach one. So from a call to men and all his well-meaning brothers. Sisters, we ain't got nothing but love for ya.
We ain't got nothing but love for you.
Okay, welcome back. We just took a quick commercial so that we could wet our whistle so we can keep going. But we just want to remind you, if there's anyone who wants to call in with a question or make a comment, please feel free to give us a call on 347-327-9611. 1-347-327-9611. Or if you know of somebody who may be in harm and you think they need some help, encourage them to go to the national hotline, 1-800-799-7233 or 1-800-799-SAFE, and they will get all their questions answered. So we want to get back to our guest. And, Marissa, I want to start with you again. We have a new administration coming in, and we know that we have been in the domestic violence field extremely blessed to have Vice President Joe Biden in our corner and believing in what's needed in the area of domestic violence and helping with funding and things of that nature. And many of our programs have definitely benefited because of his belief in the necessity of the work we're doing. We have a new administration coming in. We're not sure where things are going to go, and I'm just wondering what is your thinking, and this is probably something that both of you can answer. What is your thinking in regards to this new administration that's coming in and the impact that this might have on especially the African-American community and the fact that we've had someone who has actively participated with this movement?
I've thought a lot about this, and one of the things I like to say for us is the saying that a guy down here used to have, his name is Orion Redick, and he passed away from sickle cell. He used to say, "We all we got." You know, we have to stay vigilant, and we have to be even more relevant, and we have to be even more outspoken than we have ever been, and we have to continue to go full court press, if you will, because from the message that I've seen, the ideology of the new administration, for one, doesn't seem like it respects women. That's just one thing. So that's like a step back already. So, and the other thing is to not wait for a leader. I'm a leader. Anybody, you don't need a title to be a leader. Anybody can step up, be a part of something, or and join what's already being done to continue to press forward with this administration. Because if not, I don't believe it's going to be something that they're going to put funding toward, because it doesn't, you know, reflect the interests of the business. And we've seen that with just the recent repeal that was done immediately. Okay, so we really have to be in their face. You know, I mean, I'm going to just say it. We have to be in their face. We continue to stay on the ground. If more than anything, while the Democratic Party revitalizes itself because it needs to, we can't sit back and wait for them to do it. We have to grassroots efforts, and this effort has to be even more vocal in holding their feet to the fire, and don't let them forget. You know, but in every chance they have, like when they start sessions back here in March, I plan on being there. I want to see what you're talking about. I want to know what bills you have on the floor. I want to be able to put them on my website. because you have to be informed. And not only do you have to be informed, you have to speak about it. And I want to be able to do that too. So we have to stay engaged. And if we have to engage more so than ever, because you can best believe if funding was to be cut, it's going to be in the area in which we here are focused on.
And Alicia, do you have something to add to that too? Any concerns?
I fully co-sign Marissa's everything that she just said. I think that, you know, Donald Trump is, you know, he definitely has a hostility towards women. He is a sexual offender. In one of his ex-wives' biographies or autobiography, she says that he beat her. He is no ally to women. He's no ally to survivors of violence. Indeed, today we learned that the Trump budget came out and it plans to cut all of the programs for violence against women, just all of them, just cut them to zero. It's kind of astonishing. So there's that, and then there's the fact that he is extremely hostile to black people. He calls himself the Law and Order candidate. In my experience, I've seen that phrase being used as code to be racist, right, to appeal to white voters. He calls black communities crime-infested, which is just a terrible and racist thing to say. So I think that we're in for 4 years of heightened state violence from Washington, but I also feel that that just challenges us to, you know, get up and get out and stay in their faces and be relentless and, you know, don't ask for less. Don't demand less, demand more, right? Don't, cower in the face of, you know, these horrible policies, but be brave and confront them directly. So I'm excited that there's a day of mobilization and demonstrations tomorrow, and I hope that we keep it up the entire time. So I look forward to continuing to organize for our people.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you ladies know, we got your backs as much as we can as an organization. We support your efforts in this campaign, this new campaign that we're all going to be a part of. And as you know, WOCN. It's one of those organizations that the Violence Against Women's Act has been very good to us, and it has afforded us the opportunity to be a part and to get information out in places where we normally would not be able to go into. And it has allowed us to give information to those women who are marginalized and who usually don't get that information in order to make better decisions for themselves and their children. So we'll be watching what's going on. We won't be able to be as politically motivated as you can be, but just know we got your back. Even if you don't see us, just know we got you. So I thank you for putting that out there, for both of you being willing to talk about it, because it is a concern. So, Maya, you have a question for our guest?
Sure. When we talk about organizing and being relevant and active, politically involved in things that are going to keep women's issues and concerns and safety on the radar, and you know, we're seeing the flashing and the blacklashing going on around those things that we've been so reliant upon in being able to do our work, being able to speak out about these issues. So I think about, you know, organizations like yours, Maritha, where you have a national and international platform to speak truth to power, you know. Also, too, for you, Alisa, in terms of continuing the work of the Free Maritha Now Mobilization Campaign and the work with the survivedandpunished.org. So, you know, these two organizations are organizations that are not relying upon government funding now. And you're in a position where you can speak freely. You can speak truth to power in some very specific ways. So I wonder for both of you, what can organizing for the freedom of criminalized survivors teach us about movement building in this new Trump era, where we have a president-elect who is not victim, who does not appear to be, who is not victim-friendly in the acts of slashing funding that would come to organizations that are advocating for victim services. So what do you think would be your messaging around organizing for the freedom of the criminalized survivor? Either one of you can go first. It's okay.
Marissa, I'll let you have the floor.
Are you there, Marissa?
I was on mute. I was actually following directions, so I'm sorry.
No problem.
Well, you know, I think it's important that, you know, there's an amount of education that we give to people and help them see, you know, what it looks like when, first of all, just from a perspective of Free Brescia. I mean, saying the things, because the things that come to my mind is, this is a child that was in a home where there was domestic violence, there was abuse. And she had an adult, two adults in the house, okay, and not the adult that could make the decision that because she was the adult, but the child had to make the decision for the family. You understand what I'm saying?
Sure.
Like,
sure.
That kind of thing needs to be, and let me tell you, there's girls, young girls, and people in living like that, and it's real. And see, my issue is the people that make the policy they're completely disconnected from what actually is going on. We have to be able to bring that to people and say, this is what this looks like. You don't have a super predator, excuse me. You don't have a murderer or someone you can charge as an adult. You understand what I'm saying? You have literally a 15-year-old child whose frontal lobe is not fully developed. That's scientifically proved. So for her to make a decision as if she was a child, an adult, I have an issue with number one. And then look at the circumstances and the post-traumatic, you know, the traumatic situation in which this child made a decision based on that the adult in the home couldn't even do. You know, these are things that need to be, you know, put out there, and then put out there, you know, more and more. And I know that we have social, you know, media, which I'm grateful, because once I'm able to do what I want to do as far as speaking about these things. There's so many times that I go into a room and I'm speaking and people have no idea about some of the things that I had to experience because it wasn't shared. You understand what I'm saying? So now I'm able to say, you know, this is the decision I had to make. This is the reason why I had to make that decision. You know, I had a restraining order in place. My father taught me how to shoot. I'm very comfortable with guns. I owned and had a permit. I was in my home. I wasn't walking down the street following a child. You know, these are things that have to be said, because and what needs to be said blatantly. Because the truth is, my life is no less to be, you know, preserved or protected than somebody whose skin is lighter and white. I mean, and that just needs to be said. You basically are sending the message that it's okay that, you know, and first of all, women, not all black women are angry. That's a whole other thing. We do get scared amongst a whole bunch of other emotions. So, you know, these are things that, and if you actually are scared and angry, that's okay too, because it's a survival instinct. You know what I mean? Like, let's not play on this whole, well, you were just angry. Well, no, I could have been that and scared because of the situation. You know, speak truth to these things. This was a child. She made a decision that an adult couldn't make. Say these things. You know,
right.
So raising awareness, speak, you know, educating about this is what it looks like. I don't care how filthy and bad it looks, this is what it looks like. And it's okay. We just need to do something about it, because, you know, not turning the leaf and saying, oh, we don't want to hear it, is not going to help. And that's what they're doing. They could care less to cut the money out. But we have to say, listen, this is the next generation. You're not going to live forever. You know, it's more that if a population that are being raised and coming up in this environment, that then the wealthy that can separate themselves from us, you know, or from the demographic that they feel it's an issue. I mean, you know, these things have to be said, because, you know, ultimately, if you're for the people, so you say, you know, uniting America, that these are things that, you know, we have to talk about and then say, okay, well, let's you know, put some effort into it. And one of them is being honest and saying those things. Like, I'll be able to fully explain some of the things that I experienced all the way from the arrest to the criminal proceeding that were just done simply because of stereotypes of what they thought I was. I'm going to put you in a box and I'm going to make you fit there because you're black.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes. Just like you said, being upfront, saying it clearly, speaking truth to power. What about you, Elisa? What do you say to that?
What's the co-sign everything Marissa said, but what's the question?
So what can organizing for the freedom of criminalized survivors look like in terms of a movement building in the Trump era?
So I do believe that speaking truth to power is going to be crucial. I think that what we've seen in the past is that it's difficult to speak truth to power when you are relying on problematic institutions for the survival of your organization. I'm not saying it can't be done, saying that it's more difficult. If the majority of your funding is coming from a hostile institution, and then the institution, let's say the United States, becomes even more hostile, like gets an even more violent administration, then, you know, then we have a problem. So I think that trying to figure out how to diversify our approaches to ending all forms of violence against women is going to be crucial. I appreciate you, Sumaya, well, for many reasons, but for earlier, noting that the Free Marissa Now Mobilization Campaign, that the Survive and Punish Project, like these things were never actually established as nonprofits. They're a different kind of organizing project. They're grassroots, you know, And we never went for federal or government funding. I'm not saying that's necessarily bad to do that. I'm just saying that these organizations, their funding will not be impacted by the new administration because we weren't reliant on the government in the first place. And so we want to make sure that we have elements of our movement, our anti-violence movement, that is liberated from the state, you know, at the same time that we're supporting those that need that funding in order to survive.
Thank you. So it's sort of like it's a double-edged sword sometimes in terms of, you know, how do you continue to provide services that require funding, right? Or you don't have funding, and then there's the safety and the the lives of women that are super at stake. So it's really a very difficult situation that we're gonna find ourselves in. And I like what both of you are saying in terms of we have to figure this out one way or the other. That we really have to keep women and children and families safe in their homes as well as in our community. So as always, this conversation goes so quickly, and we're coming to the time of having to close. So we want to give both of you an opportunity to give your one closing statement at this time.
At least you go first this time.
Okay, that's good. I don't know what else to say except we have a lot of work to do. We need to be creative and we need to be bold, fearless, in fact. I think that the more news that comes out of the Trump administration, the incoming administration, the more anxiety and how truly terrible they really, really are can have the potential impact of shutting us down and making us feel that it's hopeless. But I'm hoping that it will have the opposite effect, that it will rile us up, that it will motivate us and compel us to take action again and again and again to resist this in order to defend the lives of our families and to build the kinds of communities and systems that we want and that we deserve.
Marissa? Yes, and just to piggyback on Alisa, I think it's very important for one that we strategy and we're strategic, because I believe that this administration and the ideology of that believe that we're kind of we get hot really fast and then we'll die down, and the idea is to figure out how to stay in an area in between hot and warm the entire journey as we go on, because I believe they feel like we drive off emotion and not being strategic and understanding the process and that type of thing. I think they almost count on us not knowing what we need to know and not being able to target what we need to target. There's so much things that I know about, being the, and that's why I'm fortunate, because I actually lived in that system and I got to see it. I got to see the mindsets. I got to see the culture. There's a culture. You know what I mean? And regardless of whatever their culture is, I want to be strategic in saying, hey, listen, if you want to help with women and domestic violence and the young people, then put people in there who have experienced it so they can actually relate to them, instead of saying, hey, guess what, you got a felony and you can't do it. There's so many convicted felons or felons that have records that are doing so well. My cousin is one of them, okay, that can say, hey, I used to be in the street. Let me show you this. As a survivor, I go into the women's center, the juvenile center, and I can say, listen, let me tell you what I experienced. And I had a college education. This doesn't know any, this doesn't matter what creed you are. It's really interesting to me that the idea, and to me, the strategic approach to them is to remove hope. And if you don't have hope, that's why the kids don't care. They don't believe they're going to live. People are living in poverty. They don't have hope. And that's the reason why, I'm going to be honest, why I feel like I was pursued so heavily, because I was smart and intelligent enough to do exactly what I'm doing now with speaking and to start a nonprofit and continue to move forward. Anybody else? I don't believe it would have been the same thing. But because I had the opportunity to inspire hope and speak and educate, of course you would want to get rid of me, because then that gives people hope. So I want to continue. I think we're going to need to continue to be strategic in, you know, implanting that hope and figuring out a way how we can get to the people who need it the most, and get people that they can relate to, so that then we can help them. You know what I mean? And there's not be these this red tape that blocks people off from being able to relate to, you know, somebody and say, hey, I can, and if you did it, I can do it. You know, that's not what they see. You know, they don't see the people who failed and they got back up. They don't see that anymore. You know, it's to me, designed to remove hope. You remove hope, then where's your vision and where's your willingness to continue if you don't have hope? So I believe we just have to be strategic in our efforts that we are doing now, and inspire and continue to inspire, you know, the hope to say, hey, we might be here right now, but this is what we have, and look where I've come from, and look where she's come from. You can, and we can do it.
Right, and we will. Thank you so much, both of you, for being our guest tonight, and I really appreciate all that you shared with us tonight. I'm going to share my last word and then pass it to Miss Alice. I agree with you that, you know, this fear baiting and all of the hopelessness that is being put into the collective consciousness is by design. There's a saying that says, iron sharpens iron. And I believe that if you lead with an iron hand, that the people at the bottom will rise up, and they will be sharp. I believe that we are, as we at the Women of Color Network have, you know, done so many things and taken actions to enhance leadership, that we have some of the sharpest leaders in this country, over 1,000 in our network. And I believe that we've all been prepared for what we call this quote-unquote Trump era, and that we will come out. We will go through, and we will come out, and we will be okay. Hard, but we will. So, Ms. Alice, I turn the last words over to you, and then we will end our show for tonight.
Okay, real quick. Thank you, ladies, for joining us. This has been a message that we all needed to hear, and I just want you to know, Marissa, on the 27th of this month, you will be in our thoughts and in our prayers, and wherever I'm at, I'm going to stand up and just cheer. And if people, I might not tell them, because I think you deserve a big cheer and a big round of applause, because you have showed us how to handle this with dignity. And I think that is. And so I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you, Elise, for being on the show with us and for sharing your wisdom. And as we leave, I just want everyone to know that if you know someone who you think might need help, have them call 1-800-799-7233, 1-800-799-SAFE. So thank you, everyone. Remember the 27th. And get up and cheer along with me. Who knows, if we all, if enough of us do it, may be heard across the country. We
That's
love
right.
you, we love you, and have a great evening. And thanks That's to our right. listening audience.
You
Take care.
Much. Good night.
Night.
Good night. Thank you for joining the Women of Color Network. Thank you for joining the Women of Color Network, Inc. radio show hour. The Women of Color Network, Inc. works to end violence against all women by centralizing the voices and leadership of women of color in their communities. If you are in danger or feel unsafe in your homes or relationships, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233. That's 1-800-799-SAFE.
Well, that's it for today's show. You've been listening to IDVAC Blog Talk Radio, right here every week at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. IDVAC Blog Talk Radio is brought to you by the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community in collaboration with the Women of Color Network and the African American Domestic Peace Project. Visit us on the web at idvac.org to find out more information about our guests and presenters, and to download podcasts of previous shows of IDVEC Blog Talk Radio. Until next week, be safe.